Buddhasa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa.
Who was that? Was it you that said tomorrow today is question and answer day? Somebody said that, so I thought, oh, good.
Well, I had a question for you. Sorry.
It's kind of nice, you know.
Yeah.
It's question and answer day, then I don't have to do nothing. So Thursday is basic Buddha Dharma, and Friday is question and answer. That's good.
Sorry.
Yeah. You have a question?
I guess we were talking about sort of last night, and that is the what's the relationship between the teaching of Buddhism and the Western mysteries? In the sense of are they parallel, or are they very different, or how can you work with them, make it work with them? Are you going to come across contradictions, or do you get?
Well, first thing you know is that both of them are arisings from the consciousness. Representing, therefore, also just like any action reflects the actor. So also these systems both give information about the consciousness that conceives them. So they are both maps of consciousness. In that way you could say that. Couldn't you say that? That would be a reasonable thing to say. They're both maps of consciousness. They're maps of consciousness based on... I don't know if you've ever... Have you ever read any of the old philosophers? Plato and Socrates? And
mm-hmm.
Read any of them?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you find, when I read the philosophy, the beginning philosophies, please come right over and sit by the wall there and you can lean. You read those basic philosophers, I always get the feeling that we're still asking the same questions. Do you get that feeling?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, not that I know, but it seems like that somehow.
Yeah. Still analyzing material to break it down to its finest particles. Trying to understand, hello. And still... wondering whether there is an ideal, absolute ideal. And, you know?
Yeah.
The basic, the Stoics. And the, you know what the word Stoic comes from? So the porch, a Greek porch was called a Stoa. S-T-O-A. So all the guys that hung out on the porch... became known as the Stoics. So, yeah, the respectful aspect of any system is that it is a movement of consciousness to try to comprehend. First of all, usually, the meaning, and second of all, is the meaning necessary of existence, right? The meaning of existence. The other thing you know about any system is that it is basically, if we are studying a system, we're studying a system that is suitable for humans. In fact, for example, in Buddhism, one of the startling to me when I first read it, things that the Buddha said was that the teaching that he gave was created for the sake of humans. And I found that to be a very curious statement. You know, like, oh, really? Like, so who else could you give a teaching? And what would a teaching to a fly look like? Or something like this. Like. But that's, you know, it's very interesting, isn't it? That it is a system, any religion, from my point of view, any religion is a system to try to come to some sense of comprehension and liberation. From what? Liberation from suffering. That's what Christianity's aim is, isn't it? Believe in the Christ, the truth shall set you free. Free from what? Free from damnation, right? Free from pain. And in Hinduism, you're evolving, with the exception of mystical Hinduism, you're evolving and to a point where you achieve a state that does not need evolution. It's a freedom state. Sufi, the longing for the friend, the longing of the heart, the great pull of the heart for consummation in love. And love is cessation of suffering. Buddhism. I mean, it's blatant in Buddhism. There is suffering, there is a cessation of suffering, period. And so forth. I think if you look at any of the teachings, like the aspect of what we will call for the moment compassion, is the most, the strongest mark of a teaching. The desire to be liberated from suffering, which is compassion. And really, that's all any of us really want, isn't it? I mean, if I could just find the perfect man who really loved me the way I do, I need a car too. But the job, the right, all of those things—they're all because we assume some quality of not caught in suffering, and from that same thing comes all of our rules about right and wrong. All of our morality is based on desire to be free of suffering. What else could it be based on? Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
So any time you have any system that is evolved from the mind of humans, there are going to be very definite similarities, very definite, for the goal will be the same. Perhaps the terminology for the goal, perhaps the way of framing the goal is different. In Christianity, there is great stress placed on two aspects. One of them, God is a creator God, and the other is Christ is his only begotten Son, which are not found in the Buddhist tradition, but almost everything else in Christianity you could find absolutely in Buddhism, and you can find it in the Western mysteries. There is no creator God because there is no beginning point. There is, for the same reason, there is no self. Because there's no beginning point, there's nothing inherently. Everything is interdependent in Buddha Dharma. It's like a weaving, you know, you pick up one thread, you get the whole thing. So, what you're asking, and generally speaking, I would say, that it is very wonderful to respect every teaching you meet because it is a map of human consciousness. And the parts of it you don't like will probably have really good rich rewards for you to allow you to see parts of yourself that you haven't quite found the way to see. You don't have to necessarily agree with them. But if you actually dislike them, there's probably something about your own consciousness that you don't want to accept, and that's not the way to be free of suffering. Do you want to be more specific in your question? I've given you a very general answer.
With the teaching, or let's say within, like, do the two complement one another, or are they opposed?
All teachings can complement one another, or they can be at war. It's, you know, I think the High Priestess card represents war and peace. Does she not?
The High Priestess.
Isn't it?
I have to
look at the what that says for that. That's the right side.
The Tarot. Right? War and peace. You know, it can either way. Peace, war. Water in the Tibetan tradition, and indeed in all the Buddhist traditions, water is, that's lovely by the way, water is either peace or war, peace or anger. It's peaceful if you understand, you know, if it's, okay, I'll do it the other way around. It's anger if you want to be your own self-contained little pond, you know, and all your water covers everything that's in the bottom of your pond, so it all looks like water and there's nothing that disturbs it and it's all one color and you got one answer that you got. It's called my pond, right? And then a damn raindrop falls in and you're doing a perfect reflection of everything around you, so you have a feeling like you're coping really well with the entire world, right? Because you're in total harmony with everything around you. And then this drop of water goes and all your harmony goes. So usually what you do at that point is you freeze. Not moving.
Peace.
And you reject any other concept. And you get really angry if something interferes because your desire is peace. You want an answer that covers everything. And when something comes in that upsets that, the feeling is they are upsetting me. The feeling often is not, oh gee, a greater realm to explore whether peace is possible. Right? It's not, I don't know, it's,
there's a mistake here.
Does that make sense? So that water also represents both war and peace, because there is nowhere in these traditions that you can go that there is not some form of water, and it isn't always in a pond. It can be in steam, it can be in urine, it can be in blood, it can be in an ocean, it can be in fog, it can be in mist, it can be in your lungs with your breath. But mostly, it is always moving. It can be in ice, it can be in the tropics, and can, in any form, can have harmony with the environment, can adapt. So that's peace. Okay. So really it is not whether or not one can reconcile two paths, like for example Western mysteries and Catholicism or Buddhism and Catholicism. That's not the issue. The issue is, are you more interested in maintaining your feeling of being right than you are in understanding the universe? Is your answer more important than a really good question? Do you need to feel like you've got security in a small fixed view but security. At least you know where you stand. Or are you willing to practice, I don't know. And it requires honesty when that question comes up. Because the first thing you need to know about that is that neither one of those is right. There are times when it's entirely appropriate to freeze. There are times when you're going to say to somebody, you may be right, but I don't feel like giving up my answer. And you have to respect yourself and respect them. So we're not, there are times where you can look at another person's view and listen to it and fully understand they totally believe that and then say thank you for sharing that with me. At the moment I am not able to adapt myself to it and I'm very grateful that you were willing to give me it, you know. And you know, it's all. There are some things that you don't fit. You don't have to. The only really decent answers are the ones that you can let go of anyway. The other kind make wars. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is telling the Tibetans in Tibet to please, when they're asked to denounce him, denounce him. Because he doesn't see the value of being beaten and tortured. You know? And if a religion does not allow you to be able to see the salvation of all sentient beings, then it's not very useful. Is it? I don't think so. Not from, in my experience, for me. It is important for a path, a teaching, a religion to have a way of entry for all sentient beings. If it's an elite, well, first of all, I wouldn't be allowed. We know that. And that would be wrong. But some of my friends wouldn't be there either. And some of my enemies, and then who would be able to make me into a victim, which is one of my favorite roles. Life just wouldn't be as rich, would it? God, don't take my soap operas away. Heaven, maybe, but... Embroider a little purgatory in there too, please. Oh, you're ridiculous. Really. So, if you find that you're having a dilemma, try to see what you're afraid of and what you're clinging to. I still find those two questions really useful. And you ask those two questions with respect. You say, okay, well, what is it I'm afraid of here? And what am I clinging to? And then be really respectful of what response you get. I mean, what I would strongly recommend, for example, taking the tarot, if you're talking Western mysteries and you use, for example, the deep study of the meditations of the tarot cards, and then take the Tibetan deities, I would not try to equate, you know, the magician with one of the deities. I would not try to make them the same, because they're not the same. They come at it from a different approach. But there are similar principles involved in both. So one deity, for example, let's say White Tara, may or may not have some of the qualities of, say, the Empress card, but a lot of qualities will not be interchangeable. Does that make sense to you?
And maybe that, how you used the example is sort of getting to the question is the approach or.
Yeah. The aim is the same.
Like in terms of the same.
And the way, direction that one is going will be different in all the different systems. In some systems you start with belief, in some systems you start with doubt. In some systems you start with ritual, in some systems you start with bareness. Yeah. So, like, each system starts at a point, and it's almost like, what do you call those, you know, those things on a piece of paper? Maze?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Where there's a center point, and you got to find the path through. It's almost like a maze, only with many paths into the center. And they're not the same path. But they are all starting from the same outer and going to the same inner. In fact, in the Tibetan tradition, they say something even more radical. They say, for each person, there is a new path. Not just, you know, not just each religion. Well, that's pretty interesting. I mean, there are things that are common to all of them. For example, the way that the four elements are utilized. I mean, that's basic, you know, the building blocks of the material realm, earth, water, fire, air, arising in space. And that's a profound and wondrous study, you know, and each of them has their own way of studying that. So if you were to study the use of the four elements in more than one path, each one would give you insight into the others. You know, Christianity has given me many insights into Buddha Dharma. Buddha Dharma has given me many insights into Christianity. A great softening of my heart.
That touches on a question that has risen here. Listening to Wayne's question, then it would be possible to take the elements as a study and look at Buddha Dharma and look at
tarot
cards as a conjoining, as a place of familiar looking.
Yeah, that would be wonderful to do. Or even take a look at how the end result is named. Because that would give some idea too of the language of the path too. Mm-hmm. But to try to compare some of the twists and turns of the path, it would be too difficult. It would be, you'd have to have, I don't think so. I don't think it would work.
There was another thing that would come to my mind as you were speaking of philosophers. And from my remembrance, which is quite some time ago, so could be very incorrect, of Western philosophers, it seemed that the use of the mind was their primary interest and goal, where in Buddha Dharma, the loss of the mind could be equally a goal.
That's interesting. That's interesting. I think this would be a long discussion.
Yes.
You know? just it's a nice, yeah, that's an interesting, we will pursue this, thee and me.
Yes.
So do you want to go further with that question, Wayne? Or anyone else?
There wouldn't be any appeal towards this as a consciousness arises in different places at different times. Would a religion form, would you think a religion would form up according to a need or a motive that given place that some people want a lot of death and destruction, they want a father to tell them what to do. Others, there's a sense of worship of beauty of form that the Greeks had. In another case, there's a search for bringing falls apart, what is lasting, what is stable, that what is like, nail down, having somebody tell me what is sure.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, Joseph Campbell makes a brilliant case for this when he describes the geographical location of the major religions of the world and where they arose. And he talks about, if I remember correctly, which is always chancy, he talks about the areas where there was some kind of natural barrier, like mountains, oceans, deserts, so that there weren't a lot of invasions occurring, such as China and India, are the two examples he uses, although there were invasions later of the Aryans and the Muslims, but basically that in those areas people have the leisure to watch a crop grow and the season change, and then the waters come, and then the crop grow, so that their cycles of life become the basis for the religious tradition, you know. And ideas like rebirth, for example, are very, very prevalent and very powerful, you know. And the idea of life as a wheel, life as a cycle, is very strong in areas where around the Mediterranean, where there isn't a lot of ways to guard against the marauders sweeping down. You know, when things are tough up a little bit further north, tough winter, and then the marauders sweep down, and you just never know whether it's a tough winter up north or not. And so, out of nowhere, suddenly rape and pillage arises, and then it disappears again, complete with your mom and dad who have now become slaves, right? And there is this feeling of inherent, what have I done wrong? And good versus evil being more the ruling factors. It's an interesting theory, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an interesting theory. And then he said something about, this was at a lecture he gave that for the Jungian Society in Toronto many, many years ago, about 3 years before he died. And then he said also that from that point of view, it gives one a better understanding of Zoroaster, also of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, all of which arose from that same area and with the same basic
concept and precepts of the
written text, like the Torah, the Old Testament, the Bible, and they all three of those have a very similar kind of good versus evil, adversarial approach, that there is something to guard against, you know. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I certainly think that you cannot understand a religion and the stories and parables of a religion unless you also understand something of the time and the conditions of that culture when those stories were forged. And we were talking about that earlier, that it is really useful to know and Pat's language, that the people who you're reading the stories about, Ruth and Naomi in the Bible, for example, were not sitting in a centrally heated house in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, having the discussion about whether or not she would follow. You know, but this was in a particular land with particular rules and livestock were this, and you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different, you know, rush hour was not an issue.
Camel jam, man. Please use alternate routes. Can you imagine? Watch out for road apples.
So that's, you know, that all of those considerations, I think, are very important. And whenever you study a religion, I think, or a teaching, to understand the truths, I think it's very important to separate the cultural from the tenet. The tenet of a religion, the principle of a teaching, the actual, real principle of a teaching is not the same thing as the culturally accepted behavior. There are two very different things, and it's a big mistake to confuse them. You cannot tell how a religion is going to work for you until you bring its principles into your culture. Because if the principles are going to be useful, if they are principles that are true, they should work in any culture. Now, don't go too far with this, but this is, I think, a very important issue. I mean, this is part of why I call myself a North American Buddhist. Because I am a North American. Finding that Buddha Dharma, the Dharma taught by Shakyamuni Buddha, is very applicable in my supermarket. And I also find the Tibetan traditions very beautiful, very powerful, very skillful, psychologically sophisticated. Ooh, magnificent. The Theravadin practice, very straightforward, very direct, don't get lost, just sit down and do it, and results come. And so forth. And I don't want to get caught up in the arguments about which cultural tradition one needs to do in order to practice. It's true that both of those traditions, or all traditions, have woven their whole culture through with the meaning of the principles. But we are not, when I can do that with my daily life, then that religion will be a living religion here. For me, not when I bring Tibetan Buddhism here or Thai Buddhism here. And I would like Thai Buddhism brought here, and I would like Vietnamese Buddhism brought here, and I would like Tibetan Buddhism brought here. That is not what I'm saying. I am grateful for all my teachers. I'm grateful for the monasteries I've lived in. I'm grateful for the wonderful initiations and ceremonies and hours of sitting in an awkward position in deep pain, in a, listening to a language I don't understand a word of. I'm grateful for that. Weird. Because all of it has brought something into the heart of this being and has opened something up that has given me something to share. And without any disrespect for any religion, what are the principles and how can we use them in the here and now so that for our children and our children's children, they will have validity? Let us not cling to the wrappers. And let us not treat them with disrespect either. like when the Buddha died, you know, when he was dying, there was a great consternation, you know, big problem here. Well, my God, he didn't name a successor. Ananda, Ananda, quick, go to the Buddha. Ananda was always the patsy, right? Ananda was one of the cousins, the Buddha's cousins, and a favorite. He loved the Buddha, great, deep, devotional love. So much so that he just hung out in that devotion. He never did much meditation. He hung on every word and repeated it faithfully. So he was really like a wonderful person, because if your mind took a holiday in the middle of a class, you could just go back to Ananda later and say, what did the Buddha say after he said blah, blah, blah? And then Ananda would go, he said,
da 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 da. Oh,
thank you. And he was always right. He had it perfect. He was good. He was like just who you wish to know at a class, you know? Mm-hmm. He was great. But he didn't meditate much. I just hung out in the bliss. It wasn't until after the Buddha died that he decided he should do some practice. Oh my God, the bliss is starting to get lower. Where's my cushion? Okay, what am I supposed to do? I do remember. When your addictions don't work, eh? That's when you start learning, don't you? So Ananda had to go and ask the Buddha who would be the successor, and the Buddha said, let Dharma be your teacher. Law, what is true. It also means the teaching. So that can be so many meanings. Any teaching is Dharma. It arises because of cause. There is something to respect in whatever exists. If only that it managed to exist. That's worthy of respect. In this universe that is full of formlessness and non-existence, if something comes into being, you know, piece of garbage on the path. It's amazing. Form itself is respect. First of all. So let Dharma be your teacher, that Dharma be your guide. And so then the other question that they really wanted Ananda to ask him was, the Buddha had, you know, the rules, the laws of the order had started because this monk would be doing something, and I've told you one or two of them. Like there was this one monk who had done a lot. He was really good at meditation, and he actually was very good with psychic powers. He could do meditation and develop his psychic powers. He was quite a whiz at it. And I bet you that's where my mother came from. Anyway, I always wondered, you know. Anyway, so he was in the habit of, when they were going on alms round with their bowl in the village, he would say things like, you know, well, if one really were a friend of mine, I could probably, you know, when there was really nice ripe mangoes being given up, if one were really a friend of mine, I could probably name the winning lottery ticket number. You know, I mean, he would just happen to mention this. He wasn't actually asking. And so his bowl... And then these other monks who had far fewer social graces or manipulative power, you know, weren't doing so well. Suffering from greed, hatred, and delusion, as well as hunger. And it was causing quite a lot of, you know, upset. So finally somebody went to the Buddha and said, you know, Lord Buddha, what if somebody uses, you know, the experience they have from meditation to influence people, to support them? That doesn't seem right to me, Buddha. What about you? And so the Buddha would say, oh, you bhikkhus, you know, bhikkhu means beggar, basically, means street person. You homeless twerps. Bhikkhus, come here. And they'd all come marching up, and he'd say, okay, it is not allowed that someone who is following the path that I have laid out should talk directly about their meditation experiences. There's a rule. And there are over 200 of them for men and over 300 of them for women. And every one of them arose out of some social experience, interacting with each other or interacting with the community. And they are so interesting to read. They are wild. I mean, any problem, anybody who ever runs for in politics should read these. Or anybody who wants to be on a board of directors or anything, you should read the Vinaya. It is incredible. There is nothing that isn't covered, you know? All the possible ways that difficulty can start within a community, between generations, between, you know, equals. They're brilliant. They're just wonderful to read. Just lovely. Full of wonderful insight. So, but the Buddha kept saying every time there was a new rule, he would say, you know, it's not good to have all these rules, you know. You know, these rules are just to give you a guideline. And he kept muttering that, you know. And there were people who couldn't join the order because there was too many rules. And, you know, and so he would make different rules for them. Okay, you just have to, you just have to operate by one rule, and that's the rule of awareness. And then everybody else would say, yeah, but how come, you know. And I mean, it's brilliant. It's wonderful. So when he was dying, there was this big consternation because the Buddha had several times said that he would like to get rid of a lot of the rules. Well, which rules? So that was the second question, and then go ask the Buddha, which rules shall we get rid of? So the Buddha said, not being one to miss up passing a hot potato, well, why don't you figure it out? You get together and you decide which ones have been useful and which ones really aren't so useful. So they did. And, you know, every rule they could find, there was always one person who said that, well, actually, that rule really helped me. So they're all still there. Isn't that wonderful? They all arise with cause. It all arises with cause. And a lot of them are cultural. And a lot of the rules, and they are woven through with the principles of that teaching. Within this culture, these conditions arise so that this principle is getting obscured. Okay, let's make this rule. If you understand the principles, the rules will automatically be followed. You won't be crossing. I think that North America is such an amazing continent because in a world where travel has become the norm for every country, almost, one or two exceptions, you have one country that is made up of people who immigrated. One continent, you know. And in North America, we have such an amazing collection of cultures. That's really interesting, isn't it? So what principles would evolve from a teaching not based on a culture that has stayed in one place? In certain conditions, a certain climate, in certain habits, but from a bunch of different cultures, each of them with fully blown arising, fully blown with all of their views and ideas of right and wrong and what is socially acceptable and socially unacceptable, right? So if you were going to test out a teaching, whether it is valuable, what a beautiful kind of culture to do it in. Not only has to be valuable within your little own little family bosom, How about in your neighborhood? How about at your job? How about... It's very different, isn't it? We are in a unique place, a unique time, and it's easy for us not to know that because we were born into it or we live in it. If you travel, you can see it better because you see how many other countries do not have such a mixture. You know, you go to some of the small towns in Germany and the same people have been neighbors for generations. And we know you did that. I mean, your family did that 300 years ago. That's why we have that wall. It's true, isn't it? Isn't it? How many of you have been to Europe? Isn't it true? Isn't there that quality of like the memory is for hundreds of years? And you can't really understand a lot of the things about Europe, about people with European background, until you go there. And then you realize how weird you are as a North American in this world. The freedom of culture, of exploring culture we have. Let's go out for dinner. Okay, what do you feel like eating?
I don't know, Italian maybe.
You know, this is Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, folks. Incredible. Do you want Vietnamese or Korean? Right? It's amazing, isn't it? So what kind of culture, what kind of mythology are we eating in North America? We don't have any marauders. We're living next door to a very big bicep neighbor, but the strong guy in the universe. And we keep pretending we're friends, hoping they won't steal our lunch bucket. We secretly know our lunch is better than theirs, but we're not going to tell them. Right? It's all true, isn't it? But that's really the only wrinkle on our horizon, isn't it? Oh, it's a few problems with pollution, things like that, but we don't really have to pay attention to that yet. So, you know, what an interesting, how 500 years from now, 1,000 years ago, how will people understand this culture? How could you not want to explore more than one path? You've never been, I don't think there has ever been a culture that gave so much freedom and the possibility of understanding many paths. Does that put a different light on it?
Yeah.
I hear a couple of questions here. Do you have a question, Kevin? Questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
Well, I would think that depending on the age, more or less, of people, they would look at it differently too, because of their needs or something, but they would look at it in a different aspect or a different way.
Would you like to be more specific?
Like young people would look at it, religious thing, quite a bit differently than older people. Because if religion is supposed to fill like a personal need, for them, you know, to be useful. So older people would be look or middle-aged people would be looking at it quite a bit differently than younger people.
That's true.
Other people would be looking at it quite a bit
differently. Old people would be looking at it quite differently, yeah. That's true. That's true. But the motives wouldn't necessarily be, you know, it would be the same motives. My motive is basically, the number one motive is to be free of suffering.
Yeah, but if they know that.
When you do know it, you just might have different things that you consider to be suffering. Like if you're a teenager, a zit on your nose would be major suffering. But if you're 40, it's like, oh yeah. Gee, that's strange. I haven't had a zit on my nose for a long time. Oh, it's not too bad. You know? But it's like the suffering that you're looking at. Right? That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, but people don't really look at it as the situation as suffering until like
until I learn to name it. What?
I guess so.
Until what?
I don't know. I lost track of my thought.
It doesn't matter whether you know that it's suffering or not, you do want away from it. You do wish that zit wasn't there. It doesn't matter whether you know it's suffering or not, you do wish your love affair hadn't failed. It doesn't matter whether you know it's suffering or not, you do wish you could sleep at night. You know, you do want it to go away, whatever the problem is. Hmm? Where did you go?
I don't know.
Just left the windows open and went out. I went out somewhere there. I'm out of here. Should we leave it at that?
Well,
you got something else?
I didn't know that everything was suffering until I started to hear from Buddhism that everything is suffering.
And you just got a name for it. Yeah. Now that's enough.
Pretty well wraps up the
class. Yeah, when I became a Buddhist, I really knew it was suffering. Did you hear me last night? Did I when I was talking about how they advertised me in the Dharma Center newsletter? Do you remember that?
Yeah. But did they make all the
suffering?
Yeah.
Yeah. They made a mistake there, didn't they?
Especially with the globally part. In a newsletter that I'm going to this meditation center for 3 weeks in the spring, and they put in the newsletter the sort of usual stuff about me. I read the whole newsletter, the Dharma Center newsletter last month. It was really a nice newsletter, and then I realized I hadn't read what they wrote about me. So I went back and got the copy again. I just skipped past that because, like, you know, I know what they always say about me. So then I thought, well, I should read it. So the first paragraph is what they always say about me. And then the second paragraph talks about how eclectic I am, and I'm a poet, and blah, 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 blah. And that I've been, you know, teaching, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm particularly interested in elevating suffering, both individually and globally. Yeah, and I think I could name the times when I've been successful individually, but I don't think I've ever been successful globally. So I phoned and told them that I couldn't come, Morris, because I couldn't live up to the billing. You know? I mean, I'm not that powerful. I'm still working on it. You know? And sometimes, in fact, I don't elevate suffering individually. Sometimes I must say, the opposite seems to happen. But anyway, since you were a Buddhist and you met me, your suffering is really elevated. Write a letter to the Dharma Center. You're laughing because it hurts. You love to suffer, don't you?
I should get credit for giving you some of the suffering.
But that isn't the point. The point isn't that you started hearing about it. Like, I can get wet 1,000 times and dry myself off. But one time I learned, oh, that's rain. Then I know what to call it. But that doesn't change the fact that it's been happening all along. It isn't that you haven't suffered before. You know what to name it. It isn't that you haven't got wet before. You know what to name it. You have the concept to start to actually handle it, work with it, differentiate. Well, this is suffering and this isn't. This suffering becomes more or less when I do this or that. And it's true that Buddhism only basically talks about suffering. It's true that that's exactly the point. Because there's no point in talking about the things that don't that already work. They already work. Why would you want to muck with them? You look at the places where there's pain and you say, okay, now what can we do about this? You don't look at the places where everything's tickety-boo. You know, in Buddhism you don't bother too much. I mean, at the end you do. You start saying, okay, now that you've got suffering pretty well under control, let's look at how to increase the joy. These are the seven factors of enlightenment. These are the eight jhanas, the eight absorptions. This is how you develop them. This is how you take the mind into a boundless space, and then when you come back from it, you ask a decent question. You know, all that stuff comes in, but not for the beginning. The beginning is, okay, let's look at why things aren't working and see how we can do about it. And so, you know, that's exactly what Buddhism does. But just because you learned the name doesn't mean that's when suffering started, does it?
But the teachings basically say that it all is suffering anyway.
No. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, Moses, Sarah, Buddha, Mahamaya, and anyone else I can call on. No, they don't say that. It says, really straightforward, there is suffering. That's the first noble truth. There is suffering. And then it does not say, and it's your fault. It says, there is cause for suffering. And then it says, there is cessation of suffering. And then it says, there is a way to come to the great cessation of being subject to suffering. Those are the Four Noble Truths. So it isn't saying everything is suffering. That is not true. It says, whatever is compounded, whatever is relative, whatever exists in time is impermanent. Therefore, to believe that something that exists in time is going to be your salvation, your bulwark, your continuously trustworthy anchor in life, is going to cause you a big shock. Your body's going to fall apart. Your career's going to disappear. Your friends might become your enemies, and your enemies might become your friends. You just don't know. To wish things to be what they are, what you want them to be, rather than what they are, is suffering. Far better to wish things to be what they are than what you want them to be. Or the way I say it, and I was very happy the day I discovered that I was a lot it was a lot easier on me if I expected people to do exactly what they did, rather than had expectations of them. But when I met someone, I expected them to do what they did. Then I was always pleasantly surprised, because I didn't know what they were going to do until they did it. So I actually heard them. I was actually there. And they were pleasantly surprised, because I was actually here, in a real conversation with them. It's called respect. Isn't it? When you actually can listen to somebody actually, it's called respect. And speak to them actually, it's called respect. But to want them to be what I think they should be is not respect. And it leads to suffering. So that's, you know, that's what it's saying. It's saying to try to make something that is relative, permanent, it's going to cause you pain. To try to make something that is unreal real is going to cause you pain. To try to make something that is unpure pure, it's not going to work. You know, I don't think it's saying everything is suffering. It's saying, pay attention. Don't close your eyes and pretend you're in la-la land. You're not. There is impermanence. There is dissatisfactoriness. There is cause and effect. Cause and effect does operate globally as well as individually. What arises and happens to you is not necessarily your karma, but it certainly is an action and then a reaction, and it could be a reaction of something that started 100 years ago, you know? You don't know. What's the chaos theory? The butterfly flaps their wings and something happens at the pole. That's very close to the Buddhist teaching of cause and effect. Chaos theory. Very close. But the truth is, you know, if you get mugged on the street, it's probably the whole neighborhood's problem. Not yours. Could be yours, but it's probably everybody's problem. Does that make sense to you?
Well, it sort of seems to be closing in.
What?
In la-la land, there's lots of space.
Yeah, it's true.
Now,
you're right.
Yeah. I can't put my face this way or that way because, you know, like,
yeah,
who
right.
knows what'll happen.
Well, exactly. And it now that's, yeah, it is. It is closing in. It's in your face. Life is in your face. But if you treat life like that without fear, with a sense that it's in your face inviting you for tea or to have a cigar or something, why not? Why can't it be in your face with joy? Why can't it be worthwhile in your face? Why does it have to be closing in a negative? It could be coming at you to tell you you are the crown prince of the universe in every moment. You don't know. So to assume the negative is not so smart either. And again, teaching of Buddhism starts with developing a sense of wholesomeness so that you don't assume the negative, you assume the positive. If you do not have a basic foundation of feeling positive about yourself and about what everybody around you is more or less doing, you don't have a hope in heaven, hell, or earth of being here in your face. Because the adrenaline will kill you, if nothing else. You have a major heart attack. Oh my God, they're coming at me from all sides! Ha ha ha. cheesecake. Oh, she was just thinking about it. Isn't it nice to spend time with somebody who is thinking about bringing me a cheesecake? I should have. Much better attitude. Isn't it? And it's the power of your own mind to do that. The only reason you want to go off in la-la land is because you're afraid of what might come to you here. You don't like it. Some pretend you like everything that's coming to you here, and you might find you actually do. There's an outside chance it might work. It's worth a try. So you get these meditations where you're supposed to walk around pretending everybody is the Buddha. Neat, eh? Unless, of course, you're guilty. You're waiting for him to tick you off. You know. But generally, you know, how wonderful. Everybody else. It's like in the Sufi tradition where they say everyone you meet is God's stranger. Stranger to you, but a messenger from God. Isn't that beautiful? Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly the same as everything. How beautiful. What a good attitude. That's what I would call a good attitude. So that you're operating from that basis, not about what disappointment is going to come from you, to you, from those around you, but how you can become more intimate with a friend of God's. What you have already been given, not what you don't have. Or what you're not going to get. So then things can close in on you, because all that's closing in on you is opportunity. Does that make sense?
It's like you deal with the arising all the time, continually.
Continuously. Yeah. And that's exactly what's happening. We're continuously arising out of the void. At every moment, awakening is possible. Or, at every moment, I've got to figure out what you want. Which do you prefer? And not la-la land, not, oh, I'm sure you're going to treat me like, oh, how could you, how could you? Oh, I trusted you and look what happened, not, you know.
Yeah, the drama continues.
Hmm?
The drama continues.
Yeah, no drama. Clearly being present, clearly believing people are going to do exactly what they do, and you have equal power to them. Trusting someone does not mean you give them your power. It means you're willing to be wrong. You're willing. Because it's worth it.
There's also the power of forgiveness, too. Like something like that happens. That's the one that kicks in the most for me. I've got an option. I can either play my cards out with how could you, and go on in that line of thinking. And it's kind of, maybe it's got a certain kind of quality for a while, but it certainly burns out really quick. And you're usually all by yourself in your apartment, just sort of lost inside your own skull brain, going, well, what's this all about? And the rest of the world is continuing on.
Yeah, nobody notices.
Nobody notices, yeah, exactly.
I mean, who can you play
to? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's just that.
And about the third time you tell this story, people started avoiding you.
Yeah,
they started just, as you open your mouth to mention it, it just sort of the room clears.
She's gonna go.
Sorry, I hear the phone. Yeah, it's too bad about that. Yeah. So then one changes. That's true. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints?
It struck me at times I spent a little time visiting the Dharma Center in the early days, and didn't know if they were. And I went with great expectations of everybody. They were holy. And everybody here was very special, including me, because we were on the path. And we've got a red cord through it. When people blew up, disappointed, the dumb thing, referred to certain neurotic trips, I was so amazed until I found myself raging and angry at it.
Getting really angry that those people were being angry.
That's why Dr. Peter weren't having a beard.
Yeah. How could they?
They're old. Jim Crow is in Whitehorse. Oh, Bill Bollinger is in Southern Rhodesia. We lost track of them all. They're gone. There's a whole bunch of different faces. And look at them. I have no expectancies of anything for anybody in my mind. Mm-hmm. This is, I found it worked better than I hadn't been.
Yeah. Or expect people to do exactly what they do. Either don't expect anything or expect them to be who they are.
Yeah, but no expectations from my back.
No projections.
But they're not in the world to be fulfilled.
Sadly. Sadly, this is true.
Back.
Yeah. Sadly, this is true. And until I am queen of the universe, I will expect people to do what they do.
Yeah. So try to figure it out.
Right.
Face to face.
Yeah.
So how do you practice that, to expect people to do exactly what they do?
Practice approving of them. You know, I found that was, for me, a real key. That when I would find myself getting uptight about someone, I would practice approving of them. And sometimes trying to image where that pattern of speech or way of thinking, what kind of culture it would have or what would cause it. You know? Giving it meaning. That's another thing I did. And when all else failed, I would look at the light shining off their eyes or watch how the muscles moved in their lips when they talked and get totally fascinated. So watch the muscles moving in my lips. So just start watching my lips as I'm talking and try to figure out whether my new teeth actually change the way my tongue is working or not. Am I using different muscles now than I did last time? See, and you're totally fascinated by it. And then they feel your fascination. If that's the last resort, you know, work directly with the physical, that's the last resort. Or, you know, look at the light shining off the glasses or the eyes or the nose or the skin. And just start looking, allow the light, and imagine that the light is actually coming into, you know that one. Where the light is actually coming into your eye rather than you're looking at my glasses, feel as if the light is washing into your eyes. Mm-hmm. And that your eyes are receiving this nice bathing of light from them. That this light is reflecting off me and it's just sort of washing your eyes with this coolness. You just let your eyes start receiving it. Changes your total energy with the other person. And then you can imagine that you approve of it. Because they're such a good reflector of light. Or openers. And it goes from there. And once you allow yourself to accept them as a being, you know, respect that they exist, because whatever exists is worthy of respect, then you stop trying to change them. And you respect yourself, which is the real key. It's the real key. But you have to let go of grasping out there for the reason why you're respectable. So it's nice to use some of these techniques to work one's way up to that point. How we doing? early days, yeah. I've done it in 15 minutes. Torture here.
To elevate suffering.
To elevate suffering.
Back to the cartoon. I'll be the doorman. Which floor do you want to go to?
My elevator will be called Suffering.
I'll be able to let Millennium glitch in the computer system. Just to stay awful high on elevators on the first because all the roof is on. Changing over the computer is a problem.
That's enough for us. That's enough for us. You can tell us that in December. So any other? No? You got nothing else to say?
I really found interesting what you were, when you were, to go back to the beginning, you were talking about water and how water can work two ways. Can you work the other elements that way too?
Oh yeah.
And water is very obvious because it's so mutable. But.
Yeah, all of them, all of them. I like that. For example, fire, which has the great power to transform, right? It changes. It either slows down growth or it speeds it up, right? So it changes form, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It is the great transcendent energy. It transmutes whatever it comes in touch with, calorically. Which is why it's the opposite of water, because water contains. Water engulfs everything that comes in contact with, makes it all part of water. But fire totally transmutes form. So you get the whole thing of like the fire and the water, the pillars, the twin miracles. How? Very beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you look at that. And the thing about fire is that there is a tendency at the same time that it will always bring into being a new condition, break free of the old. There is a total sense of having to do that. Or, I'm not going to play. Or total withdrawal. Right? Either I got to transmute everything, or I'm not. You're either blowing hot or cold. With fire. You're either blowing hot or cold. Right? So either everybody has to approve of the way you have transformed everything, or you're not gonna, you're just gonna go somewhere else. People who continuously fall in love, for example, they like the love, But when all that honeymoon stuff is broken down and somebody left their dirty socks in the middle of the hall at night and somebody tripped over them, they're out of town. Okay, gone to the next lover, right? Because when it comes from falling in love, and seduction and that passionate energy into, okay, how do we live this day by day? There isn't that power to transform. It's now back into, right? Or so the flame is either red hot, like totally going, or it's flickering and almost not there. But really what you want is a nice steady burn. Okay. Air is like that kind of quality of You know, it's movement, basically. Movement. All movement is there. Sorry?
I was just thinking motion.
Yeah, motion, movement. All movement is air. And air basically is like the breathing in and out of the lungs. Which breath is the right breath? Which one are you going to hold? How do you hold movement? It's no longer movement. So first thing about air is that never stays in one place. Never stays in one place. But there is this feeling like with when you're so there is this kind of quality of air, of the ongoing, continuous ripening of possibility, and then this idea, and then this idea, and then this idea. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That joy of that delight in that power of taking it here, and power of taking it there, and the power of taking it here. Right? But then that sense that somebody else might take it there before you do, so then the paranoia, oh, somebody else has got an idea, I gotta get there first, oh, somebody else is saying something, I gotta speak first, oh, somebody, you know that one? Oh yeah, I understood that already. Mm-hmm. But really, I'm over here by now, and how come you're so slow? You know that one? That one, like that? So paranoia and a sense of plots, and somebody's trying to steal your ideas, and this person's trying to stop you, and that person's trying to trap you, and this is the wrong way to go. Hmm? Right? The two ways of going. And really, what that air energy is the ongoing movement, all activity, leading consciousness to the true understanding. All activity is the activity of freedom. Nobody owns any of it. Which is what we were talking about today. Nobody owns any of it. It's all just a dance of freedom. Cause and effect dancing. Just be neutral and watch it dance. Right? So the walking in the Buddha fields of activity. Or Earth, I haven't got Earth. Earth Earth is like the extension. This plus this plus this plus this. The basis for understanding. The basis for building bones. The basis for making a house. Take this, add this, add this. The sense of something that you can count on, trust, be worthy of. But then it gets into, well, but I've got to have this. 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 And it also gets into, this is wrong, that's not right, and this is right, and these are the only ones I've got to have, and these are the best, and I've got to have the best. Right? Yeah. And there isn't the understanding that everything throughout all time and space continuously supports one, and you've got absolutely as much as you need to stand on just under the size of your foot. Mm-hmm. You need as much ground as you're supported by right now. And you don't need more. That the only thing you need for support is the present. What you own, what is operating, what is enriching you in the present is all the earth you need. Does that make sense to you? Whether it's positive, whether it's negative, non-issue. How, but that you are blessed by these fruits, this arising, this truth. Mother Earth, born out of support in every moment. Both meanings of born, you know, being born, mm-hmm. holding up, and being birthed So it's that coveting or that total richness, no matter where you go. Absolutely nouveau riche. Magnanimous with it. And they all arise in space. And the space, you know how you feel? Some days you wake up and you feel like it must be really cloudy, and then you open the curtains and it isn't. You ever had that experience?
Yeah.
Or even vice versa? Because that's the space you're in. That's the space in which the consciousness is arising. Some spaces are very cloudy and dull, turgid, right? And some are clear and just spaced out. If you feel a cloudy space, why don't you imagine the space the cloudy space is in? If you feel spaced out, why don't you feel what is contained within the spaced out? What little moat is present within that? Maybe balance. Because space is both the arising, it is the alpha and the omega. It is the beginning and the end. Continuously arising out of the void, continuously dissolving into the void. Leroy Jones, who was a poet in the 50s and 60s, American poet, beautiful poet, has one of my favorite poems that starts as simple an act as opening the eyes. And then the whole poem goes on and it ends as simple an act as closing the eyes. And doesn't that just say it all? Coming into being, creation, passing away, dissolution. Any teaching is talking about coming into being, existing, passing away. And how to do that with conscious, what is it? Compassionate, non-clinging awareness. That's what we're after. Nothing else would be quite so satisfactory, would it? Mm-hmm. What do you want?
Everything.
Yes.
That is a natural state, though, right?
Yep.
Like it's sort of all-inclusive, kind of like. Like it's not something that you have to, well, I gotta piece it together in this and then gotta try to hold it together. And it's just
no, it's natural. Already present, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's just a matter of realizing you're wet.
That you're here.
First suffering, first you learn about suffering if you're Buddhist and then you learn that you're already awakened. Is that it? I think that's it, eh? Don't you think that's it?
No.
My knees are getting sore. So you know, there's this beautiful gold light in your heart. It just spreads right through your body, pours out down your arms and down your legs and out your head. Please don't close your eyes because you won't be able to see the gold light doing this fine. Aim it at somebody. Oh, sorry. Klein, Ralph Klein. And homeless people. At nurses' hospitals. At CBC. Anywhere. Poise out three poise in all directions, right, left. Above, below, front, behind, four directions. Just floods out from this room and just moves out through the entire universe, moves through planets, through walls, everywhere. This beautiful bathing of gold light. And you think that it is going to ease suffering, however temporarily. And say whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share the qualities, so there's less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Thank you for your great compassion.